Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff. And as always, we begin by thanking John Lee Hooker and Carlos Santana for reminding us so beautifully that change is coming. Economic Update is a weekly program about what's happening in the economic parts of our lives. Our goal is to cover the most recent important events, but also to pick one or two key economic issues each week to examine in detail. Nowadays, the Economic Update program examines an economy in trouble and undergoing change. For economic change to really benefit the majority of people, we have to know more than what is happening. We need to know how our economy could and should change in ways that would better serve our needs. Economic Update is a program that aims to do all that. I am your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my life at several universities. Currently, I teach in the Graduate Program for International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. You can follow my economic analyses at www.rdwolf.com. I also want to thank Truthout, whose remarkable website is a courageous source of independent news and commentary daily. Check them out at truthout.org. We always deal with your questions and comments. Please continue to send them to rdwolf.com. Please remember that we can only use your name if you give us permission to do that. And please remember that we get more questions and comments than we really can have time to respond to. Please become a fan of the show on Facebook and like our Economic Update page. By following us, you will receive updates about the show and posts of relevant articles and information. You can raise questions for me to respond to on air there, and I will either answer them there or on the air. So let's turn to economic updates for this week's program. I begin with a story about the city of Providence, Rhode Island, which has a lesson for all Americans. Like virtually every other city and town in the United States, the economic crisis, now in its fifth year, has really hurt their finances. With more people unemployed, they cannot pay income taxes where those are needed. They don't buy as many things, so the sales tax receipts go down. The values of houses go down, and so the property tax receipts go down. Wherever you look, cities have more demands on their resources at the same time that they have fewer resources coming in. What to do in that situation is then the political question. You could go and get taxes from corporations, from the rich, and from entities that haven't been paying much in the way of taxes, or you could decide that tax increases are not the way to go, and that instead you're going to cut your spending. Well, the big decision that's gotten the mayor of Providence in the news, Mayor Angel Taveras, has been his drive, and he's now won over the Providence City Council, to cut the pensions of their city workers. So they just decided early in May of 2012 to end, for the time being, the cost of living increases for about 3,000 retired police officers, firefighters, and other employees getting city pensions. They promise to reinstate them once the retirement system is 70% financed. That is, once they have enough money in the retirement system to cover 70% of their obligations. But that could take well over a decade. Let's see what that means. First, it means that as prices rise each year, the cost of living increase in a pension that's only designed to give the pensioner enough money to keep up with the prices will no longer be given to retired police people, firefighters, and so on. That means the real worth of their pensions is dropping every year by the same percentage that prices are rising because they're not going to have the extra retirement pension to cover the rising prices. This is nothing other than making the cost of the economic crisis brought to us by big banks, hedge funds, lenders of all kinds, the financial industry, in short, making the cost of that become a cost for average people. And in this case, not just for average people, but for retired average people. It is a way of saying to the police persons and firefighters and other employees of Providence, thank you so much for a lifetime of work for this city. In response, we're not going to give you a decent retirement. Wow. What an interesting way to solve a problem. I thought I would look into one of the things that Mr. Taveras said. He is going to appeal to the university there, particularly Brown University, the richest university in Providence, a very wealthy university, to increase their contributions. He is hoping for an additional $7 million a year from all of them. Brown University currently pays the city about $3.5 million a year. Let's look at that. What is Brown University? Well, let's see. It is one of the richest universities in the United States. It currently has assets in excess of $4.2 billion, with a B. Its annual budget is $667 billion. That was its revenue for the last full year of the accounts that they've made public. During that year, 2011, their fiscal year, they made so much money that they were able to take roughly 10% of the revenue coming in, namely $63 million, and they added that to their savings, to their investments. In other words, they became richer on top of the $4.2 billion by throwing another $63 million into their investments. If they had taken a tiny fraction of that, it would not have been necessary to cut the pensions of 3,000 police, fire, and other city retirees. Let's look at that. Brown University gets an immense array of city services. The police of Rhode Island, Providence, Rhode Island, serve that university in countless ways. So does the fire department in countless ways. So do the public schools that educate all the workers who work at Brown University and live in Providence. The university benefits from the public education that is provided, and it's one of the largest employers in Providence. And yet the university, unlike all other taxpayers, individuals and businesses, doesn't have to pay. It doesn't have to pay the same tax rate that other firms do, other enterprises do. And you know what that means? It means that the city is delivering free public services to Brown University, a $4.2 billion university, who made an profit of $63 million last year and added it to its investments because all it was ready to give Brown, a tiny fraction of what it would have to give if it simply paid for the public services Providence provided, Brown gave the city $3 million. It would have had to give many times that if it simply paid the same property tax rate as everybody else in Providence does. Wildly rich, serving among the wealthiest people in the United States, as Brown always has, it isn't paying, and it continues not to pay. And so the crisis, instead of leading a progressive mayor to question the absurdity of letting Brown get away with this, chooses instead to damage the pensions of the workers who gave a lifetime of labor to the city of Providence. For those of you across America listening to this broadcast, Worry about the pensions of your elderly relatives and friends. Worry about your own pension, because the cut in Providence also affects current city workers when they get their pensions. And you know, last year, the state legislature in Rhode Island did the same thing to state workers that Providence is now doing to city workers. This is what is called in Europe austerity, making the mass of people pay step by step for a crisis they did not cause and whose burdens on them have already been heavy for 5 years. Let me turn to our next update, and it's very brief. It's about a remarkable town in Spain. I came across this very recently when the German news magazine, Der Spiegel, which in English means the mirror, carried a story. It's about a little village, a town in Spain called Marinaleda. Marinaleda. Back in 2009, the New York Times had a story about it, but it periodically is in the news because of something remarkable. Spain, as you'll know, is going through a horrific austerity, one that makes Rhode Island and Providence look mild by comparison. Unemployment in Spain is now 25%, the equivalent of the worst unemployment of the 1930s in the Great Depression of the United States. But the unemployment and the suffering across Spain, where half the people between ages 18 and 34 are unemployed, half, none of them bother this little town of Marinaleda. And the spokesperson for the town is its mayor, Juan Manuel Sanchez Gordillo, a communist, who sits in the town hall under a huge portrait of Che Guevara, and who explains that in his town there is full employment, and anyone who ever loses his job is immediately hired by the town, where no one is required to get a mortgage because every house in the town is built collectively by all the people in the town who work on it, and they build one house after another for each family, where there is no police department, saving the town $350,000 a year because they don't need it, he explains. We do everything here together. This is a communist town, and it runs itself in a collective communist way. Does it have its critics? Absolutely. But for those of you interested in whether or not it is possible for a town to quietly reorganize its economy so that what it does is collective, where the commune literally gets together and makes all its decisions, then there is one. In fact, there are many around the world, but Marinaleda in Spain is one you might want to look at. By the way, Mr. Sanchez, their mayor, is this month celebrating 3 decades as mayor of the town. He was first elected in 1979. The third update, and our final update that we'll have time for, is to talk about something happening to recent college graduates in the current economic downturn. The news there is arresting, and that's why I wanted to share it with you. A recent study by the Conference Board, a major institution providing wonderful insight into the American economy, found that new graduates are earning markedly less than they used to. Let me just read to you from their report. Median wages, a median wage is the wage right in the middle, where 50% people get more and 50% of the people get less. The median wage for new graduates with a university degree declined in both 2009 and 2010. Even with a bounce in 2011, the report said, starting pay for new graduates is below the pay in 2008, and that is before inflation is taken into account. In plain English, one of the major hits from this crisis is being taken by the people coming out of college with a new degree bachelor's, master's, or whatever. And as if that weren't enough, in a story on the 27th of April last month in the New York Times by Lily Altavena, it was pointed out that one in two new college graduates is either jobless or underemployed. That is, getting a job in which their training is way more than they need for the job, and in which their income, as we've already seen, is lower than what they were led to expect. Here's one of the results of a study by the Associated Press of the jobs being held. Wow. About 1.5 million, or 53.6%, of bachelor's degree holders under the age of 25 last year were jobless or unemployed, the highest share in at least 11 years. Wow. Wow. What does it mean? Well, it means something that is personally cruel and economically dangerous. First, more and more of America's young people are discovering that what they were promised by parents, guidance counselors, teachers in high school, and so on, isn't available. They're not going to get that job they hoped for. They're not going to get the job they're educated for and trained for. And they're not going to earn the living they were led to expect would be theirs as a kind of reward for their studying hard and working at it. Not only that, in the last few years as the crisis worsened, many young people, when they lost their job, decided to improve their job prospects by going back to school, getting another degree, becoming more employable. And because tuitions had been rising, in order to get those extra degrees, to get the college education, to bulk up on your credentials for a job, you had to borrow money to get the credential. Imagine then your situation when your hopes are dashed, your expectations frustrated, you can't get the job or the income you expected, and you're carrying tens of thousands of dollars of debt on your back. This is a disaster not only for those individuals, but it is leaving a message with millions of American young people. Don't go to college. If you went there in order to get a better job, think again. Before you load up with debt, go find out whether the job you're going to get at the end is a job you could have just as well got without the education and without the debt. We are taking our young people who used to become our most valuable asset, skilled, trained, energetic, young, working people, and making them frustrated, bitter, over-indebted, and under-trained. If you're wondering where many of the people turning to Occupy Wall Street come from, think about these folks. Let me turn then to the first of our major topics for today that I want to get into. And in fact, I'm going to begin, and then we'll take our musical break and we'll develop it a little further. A recent story talked about the money coming out of Hollywood for the Obama effort for president and the Romney effort. And while it is interesting, and I want to talk about those numbers for you, I think they point to a bigger topic that I want to spend more time on. Okay, let's begin. In the current election cycle for 2012, the Hollywood Hall, so to speak, how much money President Barack Obama is getting, both for his own reelection committee and for the Democratic Party National Committee, is currently at $7.1 million. And currently, I believe, is through March, yes, through March 31st of this year. So it doesn't count what money has come in since April 1. But through March 31st, the Obama campaign has effectively gotten, together with the Democratic National Committee campaign, $7.1 million. Out of that, Obama himself got $2.1 million. By contrast, Mitt Romney got $363,000. So when it comes to Hollywood, what do we got? We got a part of our population, filmmakers, film producers, movie actresses and actors, and so on, who clearly and overwhelmingly prefer the Democrats and Obama to Romney and the Republicans. Let's look a little deeper. Is this more or less money than Barack Obama got 4 years ago? Interestingly, it's less. By this time, in 2008, Barack Obama had gotten $4.3 million as opposed to the $2.1 million he personally got. And part of that is because of what? Well, everybody had the same explanation. There was a bill before Congress. It was called the Stop Online Piracy Act. Entertainment executives, movie producers, actresses, actors, believed it was crucial because it limited the ability of the internet and people on the internet to basically pirate new movies and clips and so on without paying the filmmaking companies that produced them and the actors that act in them and so on. So Hollywood was real interested in getting that bill passed. President Obama opposed the bill, and that really killed it. And that made the executives upset. So they gave more money to the Democratic Party, but they gave less to President Obama. Aha. Now we can understand very clearly that when an industry is not happy with what politicians do, they respond exactly as you might expect, by either punishing them with giving them less money or punishing them by giving their opponents more money. So we can see why they dropped the money to Obama, because he didn't support a bill that they wanted to have passed because it would help them make money. That leaves us with the question, why, even with that story, is Obama getting so much more than Romney? Well, here's the explanation. And I got this from the words of Henry Sloan, former Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studio Incorporated chief executive. Here's what he said, and he is one of the few backing Romney. For the first, quote, "For the first time in a long time, there's a chance to make significant inroads in Hollywood." Remember, he's talking about Romney. Quote, "This is the first election in a very long time that's not going to focus primarily on the social issues, which are not good for Republicans with the Hollywood crowd." Let me translate that for you. Hollywood makes money by cutting-edge movies, films. What does that mean? It means films and words where there is frank speech about sex, about drugs, about the political life in the United States, about corruption, about many of the parts of our lives that we know about, but that many other politicians and political leaders and religious leaders shy away from, don't discuss, aren't frank or direct about. Hollywood prides itself on being in our faces about it, giving us pieces of theater and film and music that talk about the issues we're actually living. This makes them very worried about any political movement that would shut down their free speech, that would deny them the right to talk about these issues, to talk frankly about these issues, to use the famous four-letter words, etc. So they favor the Democrats, because the Democrats tend to be less into what Mr. Sloan here calls the social issues. They tend to be, the Hollywood people, friendly to the Democrats because they think they're friendly to them and to what they make money doing, whereas the Republicans are not. Let's take a musical break for a moment, then we'll come back and see what the larger issue is that this story about Hollywood and its preferences illustrate.
Hello, San Francisco. We finally got a chance to meet. Hey. Hello, hello, San Francisco, yeah. We finally got a chance to meet. I knew someday that I would walk up and down your hilly street. My baby left me in Chicago.
It's always amazing to me, as I hope it is to you, to see the power, both the musical power and the lyrical power, of that remarkable blues tradition that is so quintessentially American and speaks to so many of the moods that we're in, individually, politically, socially. Remarkable. And so I hope you enjoy with me using the blues at a time when our economy certainly invites it. When we broke for the music, we were talking about an example of donating to politics, providing the money for the election campaigns of candidates like the president, of political parties, Republican and Democrat, and so on. I want to go into that a little more deeply than is usually done, because so much is at stake. So let me pick a second example, completely different from the one about Hollywood. In fact, there is one non-difference. This is about California again, but I don't mean to pick on California. This is a recent story, actually from last month, by George Skelton that appeared in the Los Angeles Times. And it had to do with the contributions made by the AT&T Corporation, the giant telephone and telecommunications company here in the United States. And I learned some things from that article that I would like to share with you and to draw out what I think the meaning of it is. So let's begin. And indeed, I'm also drawing from an article, The New York Times, by Anthony York and Shane Goldmacher. In their article, they wrote that AT&T hands out, on average, more than $1 million in political contributions every year. And this is now what threw me. Every current member of the legislature in California, Democrat or Republican, has received at least $1,000. Chairmen of committees that handle legislation directly affecting the telecommunications industry, of which AT&T is a leader, receive far more. Now a quote from a campaign finance expert named Robert Stern, quoted in the Los Angeles Times article, and he helped to rewrite this Mr. Stern, California's Political Reform Act in 1974. Here's what he has to say. Quote, when AT&T gives to every single legislator, liberal and conservative, then you know there's a problem. What they're doing, of course, and you don't need to have an advanced degree to figure it out, is to make sure that whoever is on whatever committee, whoever is the majority party, minority party, leader of a committee, member of a committee, they all have a reason not to offend AT&T. Because they don't want to lose that money and they don't want it to go instead to their competitor. In the Times article, it was noted that the centerpiece of AT&T's lobbying strategy, because AT&T spends a lot of money, not just giving grants to campaigns of politicians, but all kinds of other ways to support the parties, to support the politicians, to shape public discussion. The centerpiece of AT&T's lobbying strategy, the article the New York Times noted, is the annual Speaker's Cup at the world-class Pebble Beach Golf Course on the Monterey Peninsula. Green fees there are $495, and an ocean view room goes for $995 a night. At this event, lawmakers and lobbyists play golf, drink, and typically raise more than $1 million for the Democratic Party. Tickets average more than $12,000 a person. Goodie bags distributed to all those who came last year included a new iPad from Apple. AT&T spent more than $225,000 on the two-day event, the crown jewel of political fundraising in California. In the words of one man, a man quoted repeatedly in these articles, name of George Steffes, who was a longtime lobbyist and who first began working in Sacramento at the head of the California legislature for Governor Ronald Reagan, so hardly a liberal. His argument is, in my personal opinion about the level of things AT&T officials do, is that they're approaching the rental of government. I thought that was a wonderful line. They're renting the government. In the words of Senator Lonnie Hancock, Democrat, state senator, and Democrat from Berkeley, California, she's a realist. She's quoted as saying, most legislators are middle-class people. We can't afford the $700,000 it takes to run a competitive election in a California legislative district. Therefore, unless people want only independently wealthy candidates, they'll get candidates who take money from interest groups with legislation pending in the legislature. Okay, you don't need me then to draw most of the implications. But to make sure we're all on the same page, let me draw a few. Industries, enterprises. A particular enterprise, like AT&T, does its thing as an enterprise to make sure that the politicians it needs to pass laws enabling it to do things it wants, to pass laws preventing its competitors from hurting them, to pass laws that will allow them to get more out of their workers. Whatever the laws can be used for, AT&T wants to be able to get the ear of and eventually to buy the vote of the people who make the decisions. Sometimes these are little issues that nobody even pays much attention to because they really only affect the particular company. Sometimes the issues are broader and affect a whole industry. And sometimes they're the broadest of all. They don't just affect an enterprise and they don't just affect an industry. They affect the whole economy. So, for example, to prefer austerity of the sort I described earlier in Providence, Rhode Island, from raising taxes on the rich, as in the example of getting more money out of Brown simply to pay for the public services that Providence, a cash-strapped city, now delivers free to one of the richest universities in the country. If we permit this, which we as a nation do, to happen not only at the federal level in Washington, but at whatever state levels anybody is interested in playing this game at, and that includes 50 out of our 50 states, and it also happens in city governments with mayors and so on. If we don't want this, what are we going to do about it? Well, in the past, we've oscillated between two responses in the United States. Response number one, do nothing. Treat the use of money for political influence as if it wasn't there, or as if it didn't matter, or as if it was somehow the inherent right of people with money to use their money to get more influence than they would have if they didn't have the money. We insist in our politics, one person, one vote. But we apparently accept, at least many people do, that in our economy, one person, one vote isn't how it's going to work. It's $1, one vote. And so those who have more dollars get more votes. So the first reaction to this politics for sale, this reaction to America being defined as the best democracy money can buy, has been to do nothing, to see nothing, or to do nothing, or both. The second major alternative has been to pass political finance reform. This means laws mostly limiting how much money an individual, an enterprise can give to a candidate, to a party, to a political action committee, and so on. The record of these financial legal limits is abysmal. It turns out that there are always ways for people with money and financial needs to get their money into the hands, directly or indirectly, of the politician or the party or the support groups for a politician and a party needed to ensure his or her election. What does that leave us with? Well, if you don't go beyond the two traditional alternatives, you have an endless debate over whether we need legislation, whether the legislation we pass ever makes any difference. So I have a suggestion, and one that I submit to you in all sincerity and honesty. So long as we create a minority of the population, major shareholders of American companies, the boards of directors they put in place at the heads of our major companies, and the top executives and top managers of those companies, as long as this small minority of our population sits on top of our economic system, running the corporations that make the economy tick, they are going to use the enormous wealth that accrues to the profits of these corporations to shape politics. They're going to use the huge number of dollars to systematically outvote in the real world of politics what the rest of us with limited dollars can do. Therefore, the only solution that really makes a difference, that gets us beyond the old, tired, stale, overused debate between those who want to do nothing and those who want to pass regulations that in the end don't do much more than nothing, then we have to face the fact that we would have to transfer the ownership and control of our economic units, our enterprises, our institutions of production, from the minority that now own and operate them to a majority that will use them and the revenues they generate not to benefit a small part of the population, but to benefit the society as a whole. Short of a transformation of how we organize production, we are going to find ourselves in the future as we have in the past, oscillating between doing nothing. For example, in the Citizens United case, freeing up companies to do whatever they want without limit or constraint, or passing legislation of various kinds, only to discover within months or sometimes years how easily, how much of the money in the hands of the corporations and the rich found its way to the political campaigns around and despite the laws. In the time we have left, I want to turn to a couple of your questions and comments, as I always do in this part of the program. And in the first, I want to talk about something that a number of you have commented to me about. You've asked questions and made proposals regarding something called the Tobin tax. So let me talk about that. First of all, of course, what is it? It's an idea for a new kind of tax that was suggested and became famous in the 1970s. It was put forward by a professor of economics at Yale University named James Tobin, who eventually won a Nobel Prize. I am familiar with this because I was a graduate student in economics at Yale University, and my teacher of macroeconomics was James Tobin, so I actually got to know him personally as a student in the program. Professor Tobin's idea, and he talked about it in the classroom with us on more than one occasion, was to do something about a process he witnessed in the 1970s that he found to be deeply destabilizing of the world economy. And what he noticed then, and by the way, it's still a problem, is the fact that with modern telecommunications and with a modern globalized market, it's very easy for huge sums of money to flow into or out of a country in a matter of hours. Big banks can decide it's profitable to hold your money in Thailand, and suddenly tens, hundreds of billions of dollars flow into Bangkok from other parts of the world. And then if they change their minds or if conditions change in Thailand, they can as quickly move the money out. It's sometimes referred to as short-term capital volatility. It's sometimes referred to, in simpler language, as hot money. Huge sums moving around the world. And when they land in a country, when they land in a country, it has all kinds of economic consequences, some good and bad. And the same applies when the money flies out. So James Tobin's idea was the following. Let's put a small tax on these kinds of financial transactions. In other words, a small tax you would have to pay if you moved $1 billion out of London into Beijing, or out of Paris into Lagos, Nigeria, or out of London into New York, wherever. And this would have two effects that Tobin was excited about. Number one, it would make that money less hot. People wouldn't be so quick to move it around if they basically had to pay a small tax. But since these are big sums of money, it adds up. And so we would get less volatile currency movements around the world. And secondly, but it was secondary in his mind, it would be a new source of revenue for governments, and so they wouldn't have to tax the mass of their people so much as they had, because they would finally be taxing, in a useful way, hot money of financiers. This idea of a Tobin tax, sometimes also called a transactions or a financial transactions tax, has been debated ever since. That's for 30-odd years. And there is now increasing support, particularly in continental Europe, for doing this. And it's obvious why. The population is angry at financiers for moving money around the world and in that way contributing to the crisis now in its fifth year. And at the same time, governments across the world are hurting because of the crisis. Less tax revenue is coming in. So it's attractive to do something about the shortfalls of revenue by taxing financial transactions. The fear in every country is the following. If we pass such a tax, which our people want, and which would help us in a time of financial crunch for state budgets, we're afraid that if we do it in France, and if the British don't do it, everybody who wants to move money will stop keeping that money in France because they don't want to pay the tax coming in or out of France. They'll move it to Britain because if Britain doesn't have such a tax, they won't face that problem if they do all their moving of money from and to Great Britain and wherever else in the world they want to keep it for a while. In other words, the competition among world capitals means none of them want to go first. The people pushing for it have answered, okay, then all do it at the same time because then there is no way for people who move money around the world to escape. And that's where the condition and the movement now stands. Will it be possible to coordinate all the governments? The banks, the insurance companies, the hedge funds, and all of them who don't want this tax, who don't want to have anything to do with such a tax, have therefore had their strategy created for them. They've just got to convince one major financial center in the world, New York, London, Paris, Berlin, wherever, to not go along, and none of the others will dare to do it. So once again, an interesting idea by a Yale professor who won the Nobel Prize of how to get rid, or at least to reduce, a dangerous destabilizing economic phenomena, and at the same time help the budgets of government that are more needy now than they were when he proposed it, this interesting idea has for 40 years languished, unrealized anywhere because of the opposition of the industry that would suffer from it. Once again, illustrating a basic point similar to what we saw in terms of Hollywood money and of AT&T in California. Our final question for today has to do with government debt, and indeed all kinds of debt, but I'm going to focus on government debt. As you know, and as we have discussed many times on this program, government debts around the world are currently rising very, very fast, including, and indeed especially, here in the United States, where the total national debt is now larger than the total annual output of goods and services. In other words, the debt is enough above $15 trillion to be just a touch more than the total output of goods and service in the United States these days, which is also annualized at about 15, a little bit more, trillion. And that's new. We haven't had a national debt larger than our GDP in our history before, at least not for a long time. So, what's the question about debt? Some people would have you believe it's not a big problem. We should be going into debt now so that the government can spend wild amounts of money to get us out of this crisis, because we'll be able later, when things are better, to pay off the debt, get out of it, and that will get us out of the crisis when we need it, and then we can deal with the problem of debt later when dealing with it isn't as devastating as it would be to try to do that now when we're in a crisis. This is the argument of Keynesians. This is the argument of liberals who believe that deficit financing on a scale even greater than what is being done now by Obama is what is the order of the day and what should be done. Putting aside whether they're right or wrong about that, there is a tendency to act as if debts didn't matter, as if the level of government debt is not anything we have to worry about. I believe that's a mistake. I believe it misunderstands that debt is as real as everything else in our economy, which means while the government can try to get a hold of it and regulate it and control it, the government may be stymied by economic situations or by political stalemates and will not be able to do what it can theoretically do but can't get done politically. We've been through that for the last 5 years of this crisis, so it shouldn't be a hard argument for people to understand. And debts, therefore, may not be easily undone when we can afford it. And therefore, they may be a costly item. Let me give you the most important example. When you borrow money to make a government run, you create debt. The government has to pay it back. In general, when you look at who owns the debt of the United States, it tends to be the following: rich individuals, large corporations, banks, and insurance companies. And the new addition in recent years has been foreign governments who lend to the American government because they want the interest and they want to control currency values by doing that. Now, that carries a message. If those people own the debt of the United States, it means that for the years to come, the United States government is going to have to tax all of us, people and businesses, a lot of money to pay the interest on and to slowly pay off the debts to rich people, banks, insurance companies, large corporations, and foreign governments. Here's something we know. The money we all have that the government taxes away from us is money we would have spent here in the United States on goods and services, and that we cannot and will not spend when it's taxed away from us. But what we also know is that if you take money away from average people who spend everything they get and therefore create demand for goods and services with everything they have, if you take money away from them in a tax and you give it to rich people, banks, insurance companies, large corporations, and foreign governments, we know they will spend less of that money on goods and services in the United States than the American people being taxed to cover that debt would have spent. In other words, it will be a perpetual drag on the American economy, making it less busy, less goods and services purchased, and therefore less jobs producing them than would have been the case if we didn't borrow. If instead the government had gone to, guess who? The rich, the banks, the large corporations, the insurance companies, and gotten the money from them to enable the government to do what it needed to do here in a crisis without borrowing. Indeed, when you remember that taxing corporations, banks, insurance companies, and the rich is to get the money from them, which if we don't tax them, we will actually go back to them and borrow the money from them. It is always better for the government to tax those people and those corporations than to borrow from them. When we borrow, we have a long-term debt that weakens the American economy. When we tax them, we avoid that problem. Thank you very much for being with me on Economic Update today, and I hope that we can rejoin the conversation on Economic Update next week. This is Richard Wolff, hoping you will enjoy sharing that time with me again next week.
After a while, going to mine won't be mine. One of these days, a morning drawn in bed. Try, won't be long. Thing gonna change. Sometime in the middle of the night, I get so lonely, so lonely, so lonely. Thing gonna change. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Thing gonna change. Of the road, babe.